Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Graeme McQueen. Graeme is founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. He participated in developing peace-building projects in a number of countries, including Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. And he's done a great deal more, including one of the initiatives that he is proud of, a very important one we've discussed before in this program, and we certainly will again. I'm talking about Consensus 9/11. It's a vital initiative put together by David Gray Griffin and a number of other people, distinguished panel members, whose sole purpose is to separate important truths from lies that need to be dispelled. And the lies proliferate. Of course, you don't hear too much about 9/11, except around anniversaries where you get the usual things other than what people need to know, namely the truth. That is verboten, especially on scoundrel media, my new name for it. Not, well, you can call it major media. I call it scoundrel media because they certainly refuse to disclose truth and full disclosure in all ways. They never do it, especially on the issues mattering most. Graeme, I welcome you, and we can begin on Consensus 9/11. It's such an important initiative because we've had a decade of horrors following that horrendous day. And the day it happened, few of us understood what on earth was going on. It just didn't seem right to me that day. But who knew? I mean, a mere mortal like me, who knew? Thinking about it, it's hard to imagine just how bad it's been. Anyway, Graeme, I welcome you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's great to be back on the show. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you.
Oh, it's a great honor for me and joy, Graeme, to have you on. Shall we begin with Consensus 9/11? And you're part of it. You're part of the initiative with a wonderful group of other panel members. And I can't think of much anything much more important than what you're doing. If the majority of people, if most people in America understood the truth about this, and understood the horrors that followed from that day, and who's responsible and why, I don't think the criminals running this country would be getting away with what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I agree, Stephen, and that's why I've chosen to give some years of my life to the 9/11 issue generally. Let me just try and put the Consensus 9/11 project in context. This is my own interpretation. So, okay, 10 years go by since the attacks of so-called 9/11. I wish we could find a better thing to call it because I think the moment we use the term 9/11, we're reinforcing a certain traumatization that's been induced into people. But anyway, the September 11th attacks, 10 years go by. The official myth is being propagated all over the place. Dissent from that myth still largely taboo in the major media, in the universities, in the political parties. So what do? Well, we have to then say, we've done 10 years of research on this. We know a lot. Let's start consolidating it. It's time, instead of just frantically going off and doing more research, it's time to start consolidating. What are our strongest pieces of evidence? And this could be useful both for those of us in the movement itself and for people who aren't in the movement when we want to talk to them, and that includes the media. You know, if somebody in the media gets genuinely interested in this, and there are such people from time to time, what do we present them with? What can we give them in terms of our strongest points and the evidence to back up those points? Now, I first became involved in this issue. I spent much of last year helping to organize a set of hearings in Toronto. These were 4 days of hearings. The brief term for it is the Toronto hearings on 9/11. There's a longer title, but we don't need to go into that. The gist was to bring together some of the strongest evidence that we had gathered over 10 years and present it over 4 days. So we did that. And as you know, as that process was developed, how do we decide what points to include and what points not to include, we had to go through this the same kind of process in some ways as the 9/11 consensus panel is going through. We had to say, well, you know what, there's all kinds of different issues floating around there. Why don't we choose issues on which there's a very high degree of agreement within our movement? And even if we just choose the ones on which there's most agreement, it'll still be tough cutting it down to 4 days of material. We have a ton of material. So we had to develop that process among ourselves. And by the way, that process still continues. The DVD, the five-hour DVD, giving some of the talks and so on of those hearings, will be coming out in a couple of weeks. Now, so that's a little bit of the general context. Now the consensus 9/11 idea was meanwhile being developed by David Ray Griffin, Elizabeth Woodworth, and others. I can't take any credit for having developed that, but some of the fundamental principles are virtually identical to those that we had to use as we developed the Toronto hearings. In other words, can we come up with a methodology of some kind that we can use to sift through all the stuff we've got now that 10 years have gone by, present some of the strongest pieces of evidence with supporting documents? And could, in this case, the idea was, yeah, that's a good idea, and let's form a panel of experts to help us sift through that material. So that's what is going on in this, and I was honored to be asked to be one of those people who was on the panel. And yeah, so now I participate, I get documents, I go through them, I render my opinion, and that's slowly building up momentum.
Well, again, that's so crucial, Graeme, and I think most people in America, and unfortunately the U.S. public, is so out of the loop on literally the most important things that affect their lives.
Yeah.
And it's shocking and shameful, and that's why people who are up to no good literally get away with it with impunity. Most people have no idea what's going on. They don't pay attention to it. They have a little bit of information here or there, but
yeah,
Still the majority of people rely on U.S. television for their so-called news and information.
That's
and
right.
Too many don't realize that you don't get any there. You
yeah,
get the party
right.
line
yeah.
they want to give you, and that's it.
Yeah, you're right, and I'm glad you focus on that, because that really has become a crucial element of uniting a country, in this case the United States, around a set of myths and lies, and selectively telling people things and not telling them other things that are crucial to defending themselves against what's being done to them. I can't say it's a whole lot better in Canada. I think we haven't gone quite as far down this route as you guys, but it's certainly not good. We have a government that also tries to keep the lid on these issues and so on. So, I experience the same thing. And it's a really tough struggle. So obviously the kind of thing that you're doing here in alternative media is extremely important.
I just wish I had millions of listeners the way the big boys get the
yeah.
big audience numbers. Well, of course, on small operations, and it goes out online. Of course, we reach the world.
Yeah.
I have listeners that tune in, most of them through archives, which is very easy. People
yeah.
can listen anytime at all. And when you get people that listen from around the world, it's a little afternoon in Chicago where I live. An hour later in the Eastern time zone,
yep.
but you get into, I get on Russia Today every now and then, and when we're on standard time, there's a 10-hour difference between us.
Yeah.
Now there's a 9-hour difference between us, but that means that here at 12:10 in Chicago, it's 10 minutes after 9 in the evening their time,
yeah.
and you get deeper into the day my time, you get up to midnight, past midnight, into the next day. So it's pretty tough for people to tune in live,
yeah.
but they don't need to worry about that. They can listen at their convenience. All the programs are archived, most often, I believe, the same day, but pretty quickly, so it's easily accessible. And with wonderful guests like you, Graeme, This is what people should pay attention to. I'm just the host. I do an awful lot of writing, but sure. I'm just the host, and it's guests like you, Graham, that make the program.
Well, thank you, Stephen.
Your work, your peace work also,
yep,
literally gets you into all of the other things going on. I have written volumes on the wars in Iraq, in yep. Afghanistan, yep. in Libya. I've written two articles now on the latest atrocity in Afghanistan yep. and the cover-up in the U.S. media, blaming it on a lone bad apple.
Right.
We finally heard his name, yep. but it's he is only one of 15 or 20, yep. and there's more than murder involved. There is rape involved, and I refer to this incident as a drop in the ocean, because this reflects what goes on all the time in every single U.S. war theater. I wrote an article that was posted today. It's on my blog. It's on a number of websites, including Global Research. Others catch up with me, and they'll get it posted. And I reviewed very briefly, Graham, America's bloodstained history. It literally goes back to the beginning of the Republic, and I didn't begin before the Republic began, yeah. 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was proclaimed. It began a long time before that.
Yeah.
The literal extermination of Native Americans before it ended after a few centuries, something on the order of 97, 98, 99% of Native Americans were literally exterminated. There were no nuclear weapons. They didn't need a 9/11. They just had the cavalry, and they also had other weapons, you know, smallpox-infested blankets, other diseases, starvation, continued dispossession from their lands forcibly, broken treaties,
yeah.
all kinds of things. And then you go on and on. It just continued right through the 19th century, the 20th century, what's going on today. And I dread what I really fear is coming, more war, Syria and Iran,
yeah.
and I just dread the possibility, but I think it's very, very real.
It's a real danger, and that's something we should talk about. In the meantime, I do appreciate your drawing attention to the genocide in the Western Hemisphere. Obviously, when the European powers came to, you know, North America, Central America, South America, and so on, and the Caribbean, genocide was the result. Some of it intended, some unintended, but one of the largest population die-offs probably in history. So the fact that we're not taught that properly in our schools is part of our indoctrination. And genocide is always something that the others do. It's not something that we do. And it's a painful thing to go through when, let's say, as a young adult, you've been brought up to think that your side are the good guys and the others are the bad guys, and you have to realize that you're not the good guys. And it would even be a relief if you could just completely invert your worldview and say, oh, well, if we're not the good guys, if we're the bad guys, then the others, our enemies, must be the good guys. And so, oh, you know, we fought the Germans. You know, maybe the Germans were the good guys. And you look into that. Oh, God, no, they weren't the good guys. You say, well, maybe the Soviet Union were the good guys. And you look into that. No, they weren't the good guys either. And actually, it's very painful when you have to realize that in most wars, it's very hard to find good guys. That governments in the world often go to wars for illegitimate reasons. Occasionally they're defending their populations. Certainly the Soviet government was defending its population against the German armies in World War II. But on the whole, the people who are captive in all this are the populations. And this is why when I look at the Middle East right now, I look at Iran, and my heart goes out to Iranians. Not to the Iranian government, which I do not approve of, but to Iranians who are caught, on the one hand, between a repressive government, because it is, and the threat from outside powers, the U.S. and Israel, which could result in really, really massive destruction and casualties. And so what do we do in this kind of situation? So, you know, let's talk about that.
Well, indeed, and the possibility that nuclear weapons could be used against Iran,
yeah,
either by Israel or by America, and the reason for nuclear weapons, bunker busters is what we're talking about, that penetrate deeply into the ground. They can go through solid material like concrete before,
yeah,
detonating to get at underground nuclear facilities by Iran. And Iran threatens nobody, Graham.
Yeah.
They don't have a nuclear weapons program.
I
don't say that. U.S. intelligence says it. Right up to 2012, there is a report. There may be another one coming out sometime this month, because in 2010 and 2011, the annual U.S. intelligence assessment came out in March. Might have been around mid-March or,
yeah,
so. And there is a January 31 world threat assessment that came out. It covers the entire world, and it's got a section on Iran. And basically it says what the previous one said in 2010 and 11. The latest wording is different, but it found no evidence whatever that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, has any kind of development program. It doesn't discount the possibility that they're doing it, but there is no question in my mind that Iran probably is the most heavily surveilled country in,
sure,
the world. I mean, America has been going at it hammer and tong, from outer space satellites to covert elements on the ground, infiltrating their facilities with, covert Iranian spies, most likely. Israel's Mossad is doing the same thing. There's an article on Israel's Haaretz newspaper today, and the headline, which I quoted an article I wrote for tomorrow, the headline was to the effect that CIA and Mossad find no evidence whatever that Iran is developing nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I understand that, Stephen. I completely agree with you. They seem to have packed in the idea around 2003. There's no evidence that they've gone back on that. And so all of that is important. I completely agree. And it's also true that Israel does have large numbers of nuclear weapons, and that it got them covertly, and that we still might not know about them if it weren't for a whistleblower named Mordecai Vanunu. So, I mean, the double standards being employed here are staggering. I also would want to draw listeners' attention to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968, which is, you know, okay, if I could just pause on that. It's a strange document in some ways, about which I have mixed feelings. In a way, it's a case of closing the barn door after the horse has escaped. I mean, by 1968, criminal regimes already had nuclear weapons. I mean, the first criminal regime to get them was the United States, right, in 1945. So what the, on the other hand, so on the one hand, it's a very strange document. It says we're against proliferation. It should be saying we're against nuclear weapons altogether. Proliferation, meaning we don't want more of them, and we don't want them to get into the hands of everybody. And so it tries to kind of draw a line in the sand. Now, the bad part about that is, as I say, many governments that we have no reason to trust already had nuclear weapons. And this this document is the main thrust of it is to say, is to divide the world into the nuclear states and the non-nuclear states, and to say, let's have no more nuclear states. Let's just draw the line here. Well, I mean, hello, that's really reinforcing the existing power structure and letting the traditional imperial powers keep their nuclear weapons and telling other people they can't have it. On the other hand, so that's part of it. That's the unfortunate part. And that's why nations in what used to be called the Third World, including India, just reject basically the whole thing. Whole process is unfair, which it is. On the other hand, in a way, the document, the treaty was responding to genuine, legitimate concerns that the world population as a whole had. My God, you know, are we going to go into a global, as one U.S. document refers to it, as a war of global annihilation. I mean, they actually used that. This is what we should be threatening the Soviet Union with, the war of global annihilation. I'm going, who gave you the right to threaten any such war? But anyway, so the world population says, you know, we need to do something about this. To some extent, the document is an attempt to respond to that. And in that sense, it's doing something valid. Now, here's the thing I want to draw people's attention to. First, there's a couple of things. First of all, the document draws a line between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. It says nuclear energy is going to be needed by all kinds of people, and they're allowed to have it. We encourage it. They may be right or they may be wrong in encouraging it, by the way. That's another debate altogether. But in any case, the document says the peaceful atom is great, and not only do you have a right to have it, we will help you. You know, you should be helped. So people have to bear that in mind when they talk about Iran's nuclear program. Iran's attempt to get nuclear energy is perfectly legal. It's encouraged by this document. The Iranian people know that oil isn't going to be around forever, and they need to have something to fall back on, and they're trying the solution that many other states in the world are trying. It's not necessarily one that I approve of, but certainly it's legal. So then here's the other thing that people often forget about. What the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968 says, in order to kind of mollify, to kind of make the people and the non-nuclear states feel better, it says not only, you know, will the nuclear states help you with your nuclear technology for power, also the nuclear states hereby commit themselves to stopping the nuclear arms race at an early date, and to engaging in a process of nuclear disarmament, leading to general disarmament. I mean, that's a formal commitment by all the signatories. It's right there. And I would therefore argue that all the nuclear states are, in my opinion, are in legal violation of that treaty, which they signed. They're not engaging in a process of nuclear disarmament, not a serious one, and not one that leads to general disarmament, which is what is talked about in the treaty. And so again, we're told, oh, you know, the Atomic Energy Committee, oh, you know, they're finding that Iran may be doing this and they may be doing that. In the meantime, the U.S. and the other nuclear states are violating this treaty. And the reason this is so important is because, you know, ever since the Cold War kind of crumbled some years ago, many of us have gotten a bit lazy on the issue of nuclear war and nuclear weapons. And, you know, maybe that threat's not abolished, but at least on the back burner for now. We can concentrate on other things. But I think what we see now is that it's a huge, huge issue. And it's not just a huge issue as the media would have you think, because Iran, the, you know, terror state, might get nuclear weapons. It's an issue because Israel and the United States, which have nuclear weapons, and which, in my view, are obviously routinely law-breaking states, are threatening to bomb any country they don't like, which might have, you know, any hint of nuclear capability. Now, they have no legal right to bomb Iran. They've already broken, violated the UN Charter by threatening to bomb. So, you know, we're in a very dangerous situation here. I don't think, personally, and now I'm responding to a comment you're making about nuclear, I don't think the U.S. or Israel will carry out a preemptive nuclear strike on Iran unless there's a big provocation, and I want to talk about that. I hope we can talk about that in a moment.
Oh, well, that's a big issue.
Yeah,
because
just a sec. I'm almost finished my little rant here, and then I'd love it if we could talk about this provocation thing. But what I was going to say is I think what's more likely, if there isn't a big provocation, what's more likely is that they would carry out a preemptive strike with massive non-nuclear bunker busters, right, hoping that the Iranians would respond in a massive, major way, especially on the Israeli homeland, you know, like on Tel Aviv or something, at which point then we are in a real nuclear situation where we do have to fear the use of nuclear weapons by Israel. Anyway, sorry, I know that was long. but I wanted to get some of those points out there.
Oh, no, we're on the air, but I will say the floor is yours, Graham. Mm-hmm. I want you to expound at length with all the thoughts in your mind, and then I'll jump in when you pause on staging an incident. Well, we both know, and occasionally I will write on how through the years, going back so many generations, America is very good. America didn't invent the false flag, but America is very good at staging false flags. The ones I remember go back to the supposed sinking of the battleship in Havana Harbor, launching the so-called Spanish-American War. But I think most people know that one. Certainly listeners to this program. And then, of course, later on, we go to the Japanese to attack us in World War II, so there was nothing false about bombing Pearl Harbor, but what was false was they sure as hell didn't want to do it. They felt like they had no choice.
Right.
And then Gulf of Tonkin, the big one in our time was 9/11, America is very adept at creating some kind of an incident, which is, I think, justly called a false flag, to give it a reason to attack someone. And if they don't do that, I think the scenario you paint sounds very legitimate to me, that they might do something. You first incite fear, Graham. I mean, Israel and America have been inciting fear about Iran for I don't know how long.
Yeah.
It's gone on and off, literally for years.
Yeah.
And let me mention one thing. I have an article coming out for tomorrow. Obama has signed two initiatives. One is an executive order on national defense resources preparedness. This is an executive order in times of some kind of a national emergency, whatever name they want to give it, that the federal government can seize the nation's resources, including energy, food, transportation, private property, anything it wants, it considers important to America's defense. And here's another one. On March 13th, this one came out on March, the executive order came out on March 16th. On March 13th, Obama sent a text titled, Continuation of the National Emergency with Respect to Iran. He sent it to House Speaker John Boehner. He refers to Iran being a national emergency, security emergency for America.
Yeah.
And Obama feels it necessary to continue this national emergency declaration and basically be on alert to respond to whatever it suggests Iran will do, constituting a real threat. Well, America is agitating a threat.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very scary stuff.
It is very scary, Stephen. I'm glad you raised this. It's really, really important. I mean, let me speak at the moment as somebody who's in the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, what does this movement have to contribute to the discussion about Syria and Iran? Well, one of the things about the 9/11 truth movement, as opposed to other movements, is it's a very suspicious movement, right? Because it has seen through these major false flag operations, 9/11 being the main one, but a whole bunch of others as well, the anthrax attacks and so on and so forth. So that means it's a little bit more critical, a little bit more apt to see through government deception, I think, than the mainstream peace movement. It's sad that the mainstream anti-war movement isn't a little bit more critical this way, but I'm afraid it sometimes isn't. So, okay, so what does the 9/11 truth movement have to contribute? Well, one of the things it can contribute is to insist that people be aware of this danger that Israel and the United States will deliberately create a provocation. It might be a real provocation, might be a totally fraudulent one, but something that will allow them to carry out war against Iran. Now, of course, the Iranian government is being accused in the press now of trying to create provocations, but you know, even though morally I'm quite sure that they're capable of it, I also think they're smart enough to realize that this is not a time to be deliberately provoking Israel and the United States. They could get blown up. So I think the main threats at the moment in provocation of war are coming actually from the U.S. and Israel. Now,
let me interrupt because we need to take a break at the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
Hold your thought,
and
we'll come right back to it as soon as we come back.
Yeah.
Welcome back on with Graham McQueen. We're talking about 9/11, the threat of more war. I just dread it, Graham. Let me just say one more thing, and then let you jump back to where you were.
Right.
Let me just highlight a few key words in the Obama text to John Bonya about the Iranian threat. And these are quotes.
Yep.
And the words are, in one phrase, crisis, unusual and extraordinary threat, national emergency, quote unquote. Well, none exist now, none exist earlier, and I agree with your comment before the break that there is no way that Iran will provoke either Israel or America or anyone else. And why should they, Graham? They haven't provoked another country in at least a couple of centuries. They'll defend themselves vigorously if attacked. And they certainly have the ability to do it. No nuclear weapons, but Iran is no pushover. They are a powerful military force, and they can certainly respond. And they've been preparing for a possible attack for years because the saber rattling has literally gone on year after year after year. It ratchets up in intensity. It cools down a little bit. You've got major U.S. fleets in the Persian Gulf. I mean, if I had that stuff, U.S. bases surrounding them, a few dozen of them, I mean, if I lived in Iran and I had to cope with this, and a belligerent America surrounding me with military bases, powerful ships offshore, I'd be pretty scared.
Yeah, sure, they have a right to be. But the U.S. did this with Iraq, too. I mean, here was Iraq strangled over a long period of time through the outrageous degree of sanctions, hundreds of thousands of kids dying and everything else, the whole country going to shambles. The U.N. referred to this as, and I'm talking about the period between say 1990 and the 2003 invasion, referred to this as de-development. This is how you de-develop a country. All the major things, you know, infant mortality, maternal mortality, you know, malnutrition, bad water, all these things were deliberately induced in Iraq. It wasn't just the government that suffered. In fact, it was mainly the ordinary people of Iraq. And yet here in 2003, this feeble, half-destroyed country of Iraq is suddenly proclaimed, well, actually it started in 2001, to be, a terrible danger all of a sudden. So the same language was used, basically the same technique that you're talking about now. Suddenly it was a national emergency, it was a crisis. There was no crisis, there was no national emergency. And the same thing is being done to Iran. Of course, it's under sanctions, it's an economic difficulty, people are suffering, it's slowly being weakened in every sense of the word. And suddenly we're supposed to believe there's a crisis and that, you know, Americans are imminently threatened. It's absurd. So this is a completely constructed crisis. And I wanted to build on that because I'm glad you brought that up. I want to build on that by talking specifically about provocation and false flags. And my interest in this came partly a couple of years ago when I came upon this Seymour Hersh interview, which you probably know about, and your listeners, all you have to do is just Google Seymour Hersh, Navy SEALs, and you know, you'll get the thing. So he's being interviewed, this is 2008, and he's talking about what his sources told him about a meeting that took place in Dick Cheney's office. And the whole theme of the meeting was, how can we provoke a war with Iran? This is 2008. And now I'm going to quote Hersh. Hersh says, there was a dozen ideas proffered about how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we build 4 or 5 boats that look like Iranian PT boats? put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms. Next time one of our boats goes into the Straits of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Okay? So that's the gist. Now he goes on from there to talk about it more. But I thought, my God, they're actually sitting around. I don't know why I would be surprised. I mean, you know, once you realize they did the whole 9/11 thing. But still, the audacity of these people to sit around in the vice president's office. How can we trigger a war with Iran? Oh, we could make some PT boats. Make them look like it. So that would be a classic false flag operation. And that was discussed as an option. I trust Hirsch. I'm quite sure that he did indeed have sources. But I wanted to look for corroboration. I wanted to look, after I looked at that stuff, and see if there was any evidence in, say, think tanks and policy documents that are being ground out all the time in Washington especially. Do they talk about this idea of triggering a war? Do they talk about provocation? And especially, do they regard that as legitimate? And it turns out they do, and they talk about it with a frankness that really kind of surprised me. I mean, they don't talk, at least I haven't found them yet, you know, talking overtly about that kind of false flag operation that Hirsch talks about. But they certainly talk about provocation as something that is a legitimate thing to do. Let me give you an example. So the Brookings Institution, which is a major, usually called a liberal, whatever that means nowadays, think tank in the U.S., came out with a document in 2009 called Which Path to Persia?
I wrote about it, Graham.
Okay, so you know the nine options. You know about the provocation threat that goes on there. So let me just talk about it briefly, Stephen, and then we can do some back and forth on it, okay?
Go ahead.
Well, basically provocation, as you know, runs through the whole document because these guys regard it as quite a legitimate thing, not only to bomb, you know, nuclear stations and so on, but to carry out even an invasion, a full-scale invasion. But how can you do that? How can you invade Iran? The United States public won't support it. The world won't support it. Well, you need a provocation. And it's considered legitimate. So if you've written about it, you know this document, but maybe some of our listeners don't. So let me quote one section of a few lines. Here they're talking about what you would need in order to carry out an invasion. They say, quote, "It would be far more preferable if the United States could cite an Iranian provocation as justification for the airstrikes before launching them. Clearly, the more outrageous, the more deadly, the more unprovoked the Iranian action, the better off the United States would be. Of course, it would be very difficult for the United States to goad Iran into such a provocation without the rest of the world recognizing this game, which would then undermine it. One method that would have some possibility of success would be to ratchet up covert regime change efforts in the hope that Tehran would retaliate overtly or even semi-overtly, which could then be portrayed as an unprovoked act of Iranian aggression," unquote. Okay. So, to sum up, yes, there are various military options that we need to keep open for Iran, including a full-scale military invasion, but we can't do them unless Iran carries out some kind of an act of aggression. But damn it, they don't look like they want to do that. So we might have to cook something up, and that's considered legitimate. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, Graham, you need to have the consent of the public with you,
right,
to be able to go to war. Even despots need public opinion on their side. Hitler understood that. He didn't start World War II before ratcheting up tensions against Poland, citing threats. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hermann Goering, before he took his own life at Nuremberg, a psychologist interviewed him and asked him, "How on earth did you ever get the German people to go along with what you wanted to do?" Mm-hmm. And Goering was very frank, and he was right. He said, "Well, you can't convince a farmer to leave his land and go to war to protect his country. He doesn't want to do that.
Right.
Nobody wants to do it. The only way you can do it is scare the bejesus out of them."
Yeah.
Yep. Not his words, my yep. words.
Yep.
You need to scare them to make them think there's a threat against them personally and their families. And if that's the case, they will go along with you. So look at America on December 6th, 1941. Probably if you took a poll on that day, at least 90% of the public absolutely was against getting involved in a big war.
Right.
Of course, they were thinking about the Nazis in Europe, because World War II began in Europe. Well, the Japanese were at war in Asia, but the Germans attacked on September 1st, 1939. Here we were a couple of years later, and Americans wanted no part of the European war. 24 hours later, the whole world changed.
Right.
The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt said a state of war exists, and the U.S. public absolutely went along with it. The Japanese were the bad guys. There was a real threat to the country. I mean, the Japanese couldn't attack the U.S. mainland, but Americans were scared. Roosevelt didn't even have to scare them more.
Right.
An attack happened, and there was no television. I just imagine how much more he could have done with television, but there was
sure.
no television,
sure.
just
have
radio.
Cameras trained on the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. You would have seen the smoldering ruins.
Yeah.
And none of the images, you know, the later newsreels in a movie theater, you would see it, but but that's it.
Yeah.
And the American public absolutely overnight swung from pacifists to raging Japanese haters.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Hitler declared war in America, well, there we were. We were in the war. Young men volunteered, and at the height of it, there were 12 million Americans in uniform in World War II. Talk about a massive effort with total public support behind it. Otherwise, people don't sense a threat, so you have to keep scaring them. And it's amazing, most people in this country, there's a Pew Research poll, I believe sometime in December, so 2 or 3 months old now, but something like 58% of the U.S. public would favor attacking Iran to get rid of this so-called threat that they pose. And they don't realize, not a one of them realizes, that Iran poses no threat.
Yeah, well, I mean, they watch TV and that's what they see. But you're right. I mean, this whole idea of trigger, this whole idea of provocation, this whole idea of, and that can mean anything from making use of some minor event and blowing it up, to deliberately provoking your opponent to make an unwise act, and then the most extreme form, false flag, where your opponent doesn't do anything. You just create the whole thing from nothing. And these are all options on the table, and they're all being used, I believe, already. The so-called attempts to bomb Israeli embassies, the so-called plot to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador to Washington, which was such a joke that even the mainstream media had trouble swallowing it. This was last October. These things are already happening. I think they just grind them out now on a regular basis. And that leads me to make another point. And this is almost a no-penalty activity, creating these provocations. I noticed this when they were trying to provoke Iraq, you know, in 2002, 2003, and Iraq remained unprovocable because they knew what the game was. In other words, here's my point. You know, if I'm a university professor and a student plagiarizes their paper, I might choose to forgive that in one instance and say, well, let's work something. But if they keep doing this, you just have to say, well, you know, you're going to fail, and we're going to have to expel you and so on, because, you know, you're violating the rules. There's a penalty, in other words, for fraudulent action. Now, in the international sphere, there's no penalty. So the U.S. and Israel can keep creating these things. Oh, well, they had a plot to assassinate, you know, the ambassador. Well, that doesn't go over because people don't buy. Oh, well, you know, they tried to blow up the Israeli embassy. Well, that doesn't go over. Well, they tried to, you know, and they keep trying these out. And the major media doesn't say what they should say, which is, you know what? That looks fishy. We're going to get to the bottom of it. We're going to figure out who created this incident in October 2011. Was this the FBI? Did they actually create this incident about the so-called, you know, because if they did, there's a penalty for that. If they did, see, we're never going to believe anything they say again. We're not going to believe any of these provocations. They don't do that, do they? They say, oh, keep them coming. You know, some of them we won't buy, some of them we will buy, but there's no penalty for creating these provocations. And that's what people have to understand, and that's what one of the things that 9/11 Truth Movement can contribute here is to see through these things and to make sure the public sees the game that's being played, because the target here isn't just Iran. I mean, in your country, I'm talking from Canada here, but in your country, your population is the target of this propaganda, because, as you say, they know, the U.S. war planners know they can't do what they want to do without the support of the U.S. population. And so that's their target. That's their immediate target. How can they swindle and defraud and trick and degrade the U.S. population? That's their first aim.
Well, you know, they just keep doing it, Graham, over and over again. The people who were buffaloed the last time and they realize that they will lie to, they're gullible and they go along with it repeatedly. So they knew they were had on so-called WMDs that didn't exist in Iraq. And now we have the Iranian threat. And they swallow that big lie just like they swallow the WMD lie.
It's the same, lie. WMDs all over again.
It's the same lie. A WMD in new form. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And they, of course, they turn to TV news for their so-called news and information. And the media scoundrels, they regurgitate the big lie over and over again. They know the truth, but they suppress it.
Yeah.
And they cheerlead the big lie, and they repeat it round the clock with cable channels. And the broadcasters feature it on their news reports. So you get Brian Williams on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's heading up a CBS News now. I think Diane Sawyer does on ABC. I mean, they just repeat these big lies, and these aren't stupid people who anchor these newscasts. They know that they're lying through their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, pay them a few million bucks a year, and they'll say anything.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll backstab their own mother if you pay them enough to do it.
Yeah.
So lying to the U.S. public, I mean, that's a piece of cake.
Apparently it is. I don't like to be cynical, but I don't know what else to be when I look at the major media. I mean, even in my country, I've tried again and again to get them to have a look at the 9/11 issue. I can think of two journalists in my country who are somewhat open to that. But, you know, when you think of how many there are, I mean, it's really sad. It's sad. And the other thing here is that the International Atomic Energy Agency is really a tool of the U.S. right now. And that makes me very sad because, I mean, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I talked about earlier, is in a sense administered by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In other words, that's the crucial agency that comes into somebody's country and says you are obeying or you aren't obeying the NPT. And, you know, I know that some people kind of idolize El-Baradei, who was the former head of the IAEA during the Iraq build-up to the Iraq invasion, but I don't share that. I think he was very weak and that he could have stood against that invasion in a way that he did not. And the current head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukio Amano, a Japanese guy, is in the pocket of the U.S. I mean, WikiLeaks actually exposed this. You know, he basically is on record there as saying, well, that he's going to support the U.S. On every major aspect, including the inspections of Iran. So even when there's nothing to report, he manages to make it look as if, well, you know, we're a little worried because they might be hiding something. And it's very sad because this should be a completely independent agency. We should be able to trust it. And unfortunately, we can't trust it. And so when the Iranians express distrust, we have to kind of go, well, frankly, if I were you, I wouldn't trust them either. So it's fairly sad, and we have to depend upon ourselves. We have to depend upon non-governmental agencies and social movements here to try and expose what's being done.
Graeme, absolutely. And I've written about Amano. I've quoted from the WikiLeaks material what he said. I quoted what U.S. officials said about Amano.
Right.
You know, he's our guy. We have him in our pocket.
Yeah.
Don't worry about Yukio. He'll say anything we tell him to say.
Exactly.
It shows the agency is completely corrupted. And the best he's been able to do, he can't say Iran is doing A, B, C, or D because there's no evidence to prove it.
Right.
So he just kind of skirts around the edges, Graeme,
and
drops hints here and drops hints there.
Exactly.
I think there's a comment in the last day or two that he's in some way uneasy that Iran isn't on the up and up. They're not revealing everything they know.
Right.
Well, there's no nuclear country. There's no country more surveilled than Iran, and the IAEA is surveilling Iran more carefully than any other nuclear power in the world, by far, including monitoring cameras in all Iranian facilities that operate 7 days a week, round the clock. They haven't found a thing that suggests a nuclear weapons development program, and yet Amano has got the audacity to skirt around the edges and suggest Iran is doing it. I mean,
I completely agree, Steve. I mean, it's absurd when you think about it. It's like, well, we're not convinced that they might not have bad intentions and they might not be hiding something. Well, come on, you know, you can't prove. I mean, he's asking them to prove a negative, you know, to prove that they don't have in bad intentions. I mean, nobody can prove that. It's absurd. All you have to do is read the statements and realize they've got nothing. They've got nothing on Iran on this. And so you're completely justified in saying, you know, this guy he's in their pocket. And it's just really sad. That's all because we depend upon certain agencies to give us objective advice, and we're not getting it.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, it scares me because they can probably get Amano and some other people to say anything they want. And of course, what they really get, they get the major media to repeat the big lie over and over again and literally scare the devil out of the U.S. public.
Yeah.
So when Obama wants to pull the trigger, and I'm very fearful, Graeme, I can't say that the die has been cast, but I'm very, very scared. I don't have a shadow of a doubt that America plans regime change in Syria and Iran, and I believe they will go to any means to get it, including war. Now, whether they will, I mean, with Iran especially, I think Syria is no pushover either. Syria's got a powerful military, but Iran is more powerful. And I think there's certain skittishness, especially in the Pentagon. I mean, they know what war is all about.
I agree.
Obama doesn't know beans about what war is. I mean, heck, I don't know beans about what it means to wage a war.
Yeah. But, well, just I see our time's almost up. I wanted to reinforce what you're saying, though, namely that there are, I think, genuine divisions on this. So, yes, there's a group that definitely wants regime change in both those countries, but I think there's a split between military and civilian in the U.S. I think there's a split between certain parties in Israel and certain parties in the U.S. And I think there's a history of that split going back a long time. And we have to hope it's a big split because otherwise we're in big trouble. And maybe what would be interesting some other time is to talk about earlier instances of this because, you know, between 1945 and 1949, the U.S. wanted to prevent the Soviet Union from getting power and from establishing itself as an important power, and they came very close to launching a preemptive military strike on dozens of Soviet cities with nuclear weapons. So some other time, I hope we can talk about that.
Oh, I'd love to do that, Graeme. I absolutely want to get you back because this is such an important topic to discuss.
Yeah.
I have written how in the early 1960s, General Curtis LeMay wanted to nuke Russia when he felt that we really had a big advantage of them.
Yeah.
And even though we might lose a few U.S. cities, like maybe New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, well, you know, we could literally level the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And isn't that worth losing those three cities? I mean, people
these
actually
people
think
are,
like this.
Yeah,
well,
they're
Ted Kennedy was president then, not Barack Obama. Yeah. And there was a Security Council, a National Security Council, if I have the name right, meeting, where they threw Cuba into the mix, too.
Right.
And there was a general who wanted a second Bay of Pigs. And I wrote about how Kennedy was so furious and disgusted, he literally got up in the middle of the meeting and walked out.
Yeah.
He wanted nothing to do with this kind of talk, with these kind of people. And during the Kennedy years, the missiles of October 1962, I mean, we came dangerously close to a nuclear confrontation then when Jack Kennedy was president.
Hey, I remember
just
that.
Just imagine
one.
If George Bush had been president then.
No, I was a kid. I was walking around on eggshells. I remember that very, very well. And, so it's important to talk about who these elites are and what they are willing to do, and also the price that John Kennedy paid for disagreeing with them. But anyway, I guess that's for another time.
We're just about out of time. It's been an important discussion, Graham. And in the article that I put out tomorrow, I end with sometimes I have an ending section I call the final comment. And I've written before how I feel the U.S. political system, you could throw the corporate in with the political, but the way this nation is governed, you know, corporations run it and the politicians are their tools. Yeah. It is totally dysfunctional, broken, corrupt. I don't see any possibility in the world of fixing it. I think the only solution is you have to tear it down and start over again. And in my final section today, I've used this before, haven't done it recently, I quoted Thomas Jefferson from the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And I like to say if it was good enough for Jefferson, it's good enough for me. And he said when governments betray the will of the people and harm their interests, I'm just paraphrasing, it's the duty and obligation of the people, the right and the duty of the people to alter or abolish it and institute a new government under the principles where that government will serve the interests of everyone in the country.
Yeah.
And we have come to that moment. And I also quoted Margaret Mead, I've done before, again, not in a good long time, where Margaret Mead, once a famous anthropologist, she once said that thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. And her tagline was, and I absolutely agree, it's the only thing that ever has. If anybody thinks the politician leopard is going to change its spots, well, they have another thought coming.
Yeah.
It has never happened before in world history. It certainly will not happen now. And the only way change can ever come is from the bottom up, from ordinary people deciding that they've had enough, they want no more of this, and we've literally come to the point now where maybe their lives are endangered.
Yeah.
They start lobbing nuclear bunker busters around like their giant hand grenades, a phrase I used in an article or two.
Mm-hmm.
There is no telling the danger that can reverberate back to us in the homeland, where literally we at home can be endangered by this insanity we inflict on another country. If that's not incentive enough to get people involved and absolutely be part of a vibrant anti-war movement and say we're not going to take this anymore and mean it and literally scare the devil out of the people in government, that people actually might rise up against this government and do something about it.
Well, I'm with you, Stephen. I'm with you on that.
We have to do something, Graham. I didn't mean to hog the last couple of minutes.
That's
we are out of time.
I
will send you an email. I look forward to getting you back
and
having another discussion like this, Graham.
We'll do it.
My great, great thanks.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
And to my listeners, again, every Thursday, join us 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.